Nobody's leaving on a jet plane, and you really don't know when you'll be back again.
I would not get on a flight until vaccinated.
I don't feel comfortable taking any form of transportation other than my own car.
I just don't even know if I could do it.
You're talking to us about it. It's The Takeaway for Wednesday, May 27th, and I'm Shamitha Basu. Also on the show, meatpacking plants are being hit really hard by COVID-19. We're talking about how workers, many of them undocumented, are coping with their lives on the front line.
The National Guard was rumored to be coming to help carry out massive testing. People in the community were afraid of what that meant for them. If people are afraid to go to hospitals to get tested because they're afraid of being asked for identification.
Let's get to it. That is sound from protests that ran late into last night in Minneapolis, Minnesota, over the killing of a black man, George Floyd, by a white Minneapolis police officer. A graphic video taken by a bystander shows the officer kneeling on Floyd's neck for several minutes. Floyd died soon after the encounter. The outrage has led to an FBI investigation and the firing of all four police officers who were on the scene. We now turn to John Collins, senior reporter on Minnesota Public Radio's Race, Class, and Communities desk. John, thank you for being here. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So, John, many of us have seen that disturbing video by now. What are you hearing from all the backlash there?
Yesterday there was a response from public officials, from the governor, Tim Walz, to Attorney General Keith Ellison, to the mayor, essentially condemning what people see in that video and calling for authorities to look deeper into exactly what happened. In the public, there were people gathering at the scene throughout the day and then gathering in protest, hundreds and hundreds of protesters who then marched through the streets and mostly in masks and spaced at some distance sometimes to the third precinct last night.
And what happened with these protesters? I've been seeing some pretty disturbing videos of how they were met by police forces.
There were some confrontations when they arrived at the precinct. Some windows of police squad vehicles were broken. A window at the precinct was broken. And police responded with chemical irritants, firing tear gas over and over into and around the crowds. And this is on a relatively busy intersection in South Minneapolis. And so protesters were gathered in a kind of a downpour last night, with on four corners of the intersection kind of having a standoff with police for hours last night.
Now, according to mappingpoliceviolence.org, Minneapolis police kill black people at a rate of 13 times higher than white people. That's a larger racial disparity than almost anywhere else in the nation. Does that bear out in your reporting, John?
It's important to remember that Minnesota has had just one police officer that's been convicted for killing a civilian on the job, and that was Officer Mohammed Noor, who shot and killed Justine Ruschek in 2017. And Noor is black, and Ruschek was white. In another high-profile police killing, that was Philando Castile, the motorist, who was pulled over by Officer Geronimo Yanez in 2016 and shot and killed. The officer was acquitted in his death.
Has the Minneapolis Police Department issued any kind of statement?
The Minneapolis police chief has fired the four officers involved in this case. They say that they're looking into the actual procedures, the kneeling on the neck, and that will be part of their internal investigation. And Mayor Jacob Frey said that firing the police officers was the right thing to do.
Were these officers wearing body cameras?
The police department is saying that the officers were wearing body cameras and that the incident was captured on body cameras. And then so we have that evidence that will eventually come out. We're probably not going to see the body cam videos until and if a trial happens or a decision is made not to charge the police officers.
Right. So you're saying if there is a trial, I understand those four officers have been fired. What could potentially lie ahead for them? And I know that there's also an open FBI investigation now.
Well, the officers have been fired. They do have the right to contest that through their union, and that process could take a while, and we may not know for quite a while exactly how it's going to play out.
John Collins is senior reporter on Minnesota Public Radio's Race, Class, and Communities desk. Thank you for coming on the show, John.
Thanks for having me.
Around the country, thousands of meat and poultry plant workers have been diagnosed with COVID-19. Last month, the CDC said there were around 5,000 cases of coronavirus in meat processing facilities. However, nonprofit organizations estimate that today, that number is closer to 20,000 people. So far, 66 workers have been confirmed dead, although that number could be higher. Despite the health risks, the Trump administration ordered that meat plants stay open during the pandemic, and this has led to counties with these facilities to have twice the rate of infection compared with the national average. So let's talk about how it's affecting workers and why it's such a problem. Tina Vasquez is a gender justice reporter with PRISM, and Nicole Narea is an immigration reporter for Vox. Tina, Nicole, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Shumita.
So, Nicole, why don't we start with you? Why exactly has coronavirus spread so quickly in these meat and poultry plants? Is it the working conditions there or something else?
Yeah, it's the working conditions both inside the plants and outside the plants. Even in normal times, meat packing is backbreaking work, with workers having to haul these huge cuts of meat and carve them into market-ready portions on the production line for relatively low hourly wages. On the production line, workers are often standing shoulder to shoulder, and in those kinds of settings, it's difficult to promote social distancing unless the plants significantly reduce their capacity. Some plants have already done so, but at the same time, President Trump has also ordered the meatpacking plants to stay open and encourage them to keep working at full capacity in order to ward off meat shortages. So some plants may not be taking that drastic action. Also, plants are now taking employees' temperatures and handing out additional protective equipment, but workers might still spread the virus unknowingly if they're asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. There's also research suggesting that the virus might survive longer in the cold, kind of humid air of meat packing facilities. They're required to stay that way based on federal guidelines for food safety.
Oh, wow.
So it may spread as an aerosol, also via the kind of aggressive ventilation systems that they have in these facilities. And in the local communities where the workers live, they tend to sort of live in cramped shared housing and commute together, sometimes on company-provided buses. A recent Bloomberg analysis actually found that since Trump issued his executive order requiring the plants to remain open, infections in the counties near these large meatpacking facilities have actually risen at more than twice the national rate.
And Tina, you've been speaking with a lot of workers at these plants in your reporting. What do the working conditions look like in the facilities, and what are you hearing from people inside?
I think the most troubling part of it is that the workers that I've spoken to say that there's a total lack of transparency from the companies that they work for. I've been focusing on Mount Air Farms in rural central North Carolina. A lot of people are not showing up to work, and workers are unsure if people aren't showing up because they're afraid of contracting the virus or if because they're sick with the virus.
Mm.
And so several women that I've spoken to have told me that they've asked their manager, supervisor directly, if they've come into contact with anyone in their areas on the line who've contracted the virus. And they are told that that is protected information or confidential information that they won't be sharing. There are new CDC guidelines for poultry processing plants in which it's recommended that employers tell workers if they've come into contact with people who've contracted the virus, but that doesn't seem to be happening, at least among the workers that I've spoken to in North Carolina. And they've also reported that you can't distance from the person. I mean, these are people who are working on a line, doing repeated movements. They are shoulder to shoulder with other workers. In North Carolina, in particular, testing is not being done at the levels that it needs to be done. So people are asymptomatic and they're going to work, or they want to get tested, but there isn't information about where they can get tested. There's a lot of fear in the community about whether it costs a lot of money. There are language access issues. So even people who want to get tested have told me that they have no idea how to get tested. And in North Carolina, unless you're showing symptoms of COVID, then you're not going to get a test.
Nicole, you mentioned that executive order. President Trump signed it last month, invoking the Defense Production Act to keep plants open during the pandemic. Did that executive order lead to any meaningful outcome for workers? Some plants have closed, right?
Some plants have closed, yes, but he wants the plants to basically reopen in accordance with federal guidelines. Mm-hmm. The problem is with those federal guidelines that some agencies have been issuing in order to protect workers, they're not actually enforceable. They're basically sort of kind of suggestions, and there's no real accountability mechanism built in. So actually hundreds of worker rights groups are petitioning Congress to pass a bill that would require the federal government to issue an emergency temporary standard to prevent the spread of coronavirus in the workplace. And that would be enforceable. So as Tina mentioned, we just haven't seen these plants really following through with some of the federal guidelines, and that would really help. But in terms of what Trump's executive order has actually done, it's sort of more of a semantic flourish than actually ordering these plants to produce a certain amount of meat on behalf of the federal government. But it does have the effect of discouraging the plants from taking more drastic action to prevent the spread of coronavirus in their plants.
And when you talk about labor organizing, I mean, what sorts of things are they asking to be codified for these plants to be doing differently?
So they basically just want to enact cleaning standards, screening practices, standards around the administration of personal protective equipment and social distancing, all of these kinds of basic protections that we would hope employers are enacting even outside of meatpacking plants.
Mm. And these things are not being standardized at the moment, you're saying?
I mean, they are through federal guidelines, but those guidelines are not enforceable, unfortunately. Mm.
Tina, I understand that around one third of people working in these facilities, and most likely more than one third, are from immigrant communities, and many of them are undocumented. Does that mean that they are particularly vulnerable as workers?
Yeah, I mean, what's been really interesting to learn as I've reported on the conditions in North Carolina is that when poultry processing plants talk about the protections that they're offering to their employees, that often doesn't encompass an entirely different workforce that makes up, I would say, a bulk of their workforce, which are undocumented workers who aren't considered direct employees of these companies, but rather hire through a staffing agency. Mm-hmm. Often that's how undocumented folks get jobs at these facilities, is they're considered employees of the staffing agency, which means they get paid less, they have fewer protections, they don't have health care, and this creates a lot of additional hurdles, especially during a pandemic. I mean, at Mount Air Farms, when the National Guard was rumored to be coming to help carry out massive testing, people in the community were afraid of what that meant for them. If they were confused, if that meant that immigration enforcement would be taking place, people are afraid to go to hospitals to get tested because they're afraid of being asked for identification. So when you have a large percentage of the workforce that is an undocumented community, and they don't have access to information in their language, they're afraid of immigration enforcement, which has taken place in Central North Carolina. We've seen large raids of different workplaces, including these poultry processing plants. Mm-hmm. It creates an environment where people are afraid to ask for more information. They're afraid to seek the health care that they need. It creates insurmountable barriers for different communities.
And what does labor organizing look like when these people are already afraid to be speaking out because of their status?
I mean, it could be that organizing is happening and that it's not public, but among the women that I've spoken to who work at these poultry processing plants, they mostly describe conditions of like mutual aid among workers where some of them have said that the companies aren't telling them any information about the size of the outbreaks, and so they're relying on information from each other. They're providing childcare to each other. They're providing food to each other. I mean, I think that's its own form of organizing, but it's less formal than I guess what we think of it. But there is a lot of mutual aid happening. But what's unfortunate is the lack of transparency. They can't develop an understanding of the risk they're taking by going to work if they don't have the information that they need. And if it's not coming from the companies, then they're watching the news. So people who work at specific plants learned about outbreaks at their own plants by watching the news in Spanish. Downside of that, of course, are rumors that circulate. When large percentages of people aren't going to work, they don't know if they're sick or just afraid. And so rumors circulate that, there could be thousands of cases or hundreds of cases, or this person is sick or that person's sick, but there's no way to confirm. So they rely on the information that they have, and sometimes that's good and sometimes it's bad.
We actually have seen some employees staging walkouts at major meatpacking facilities, and one even anonymously filed a lawsuit against their employer, Smithfield, which is one of the nation's largest pork producers. But Republicans are actually fighting to shield businesses from these kinds of lawsuits and liability if their employees contract coronavirus, which would make it that much harder for these employees to stand up for their rights.
I want to ask you, Nicole, you know, our Friday politics host, Amy Walter, she recently spoke with Mayor Quentin Hart from Waterloo, Iowa. And in his city, there was an outbreak of coronavirus at a local pork processing plant that's owned by Tyson. And the plant was later closed. So here's what Mayor Hart had to say.
There is a direct correlation between a strong agricultural base, a healthy workforce, production flow, and the impact to local and national economies. If you don't have a protected workforce, or if you have a workforce where large numbers are not feeling well or could have potentially contracted the virus, then you don't have production. And with that many people calling in sick or unable to work due to the virus, no matter what you do, you're not going to produce at the same level.
So that's Mayor Hart in Waterloo, Iowa. Nicole, what have we been hearing from local politicians and industry leaders? Are there efforts to help the workers in these conditions?
Certainly on a local level, we've seen officials administering guidance and requiring local facilities to close. There was one Smithfield facility, I believe, that was forced to close upon basically an ordinance from local officials.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, he's completely right in the sense that I think the worker safety problem is not distinct from the problem with shortages in our meat supply. And keeping the facilities open and without additional protections for workers isn't going to resolve the shortages that we're seeing in supermarkets across the country right now. It really is about protecting those workers, and only then can we get production levels back up somewhat.
Tina, something that you tweeted caught my attention. You said that what's happening in these plants is an immigrant rights and a worker rights issue, but it's also a gender justice issue. Can you explain that? How does gender play into this?
When I started to do this reporting, I did not set out to cover it from a gender justice angle. I really thought that these would be immigration stories. But as I started to do my reporting and more people wanted to speak to me about the conditions that they were seeing in the plants that they were working at, they were all women. And I didn't know if that's just who happened to be speaking out or if that's who's working in poultry processing plants. I mean, I had ideas or assumptions about who I thought worked at these facilities, and it turns out that I was wrong. I started to ask around, you know, whether it was North Carolina or Mississippi. There are large percentages of women working at these plants. I spoke to a woman last week named Luce, and I asked her directly, is it just that women, for whatever reason, feel more apt to speak out, or is it that large percentages of people who work at these plants are women? And she said that it was both, that women are the breadwinners, that women have to take care of their children, that they're juggling all of these different roles, and that they have the biggest risk to take and the most to lose if they get sick, because that means that they can't support their families. It means that they can infect their children. If they live in multi-generational homes, it means that they can make their parents sick. And so, I mean, I think it's a combination of the two, that women, for whatever reason in North Carolina, want to speak out, but also that they make up a large percentage of this workforce.
Tina Vasquez is a gender justice reporter with PRISM, and Nicole Narea is an immigration reporter for Vox. It was really great to have you both here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
you been on a flight lately? I'm going to guess the answer is probably no. At the start of 2020, air travel was doing great business. According to CNBC, just months ago, the airline industry had reached its highest employment level in more than 16 years. Today, with a roughly 90% drop in air travel compared to a year ago, the industry has suffered dramatic economic losses. $25 billion in federal relief is being provided to airlines as part of the CARES Act, under the condition that companies do not reduce pay rates or lay off employees. But many of the major airlines have cut their workers' hours in response to the lower demand in flights. And while in recent weeks airlines have started to see a slight increase in business, many people in the United States just aren't ready to travel long distances on planes or other means like trains. We're hearing from you on this. How comfortable would you feel getting on an airplane right now?
This is Lee calling from Dunedin, Florida. We do not feel comfortable traveling right now, which is a shame because we've got a gorgeous 3-year-old granddaughter in Montana, and we would love to fly out to see her.
My name is Scott, and I live on Vashon Island near Seattle. Tomorrow, I'm flying to Boston from SeaTac. I have no concerns about my safety, as I have heard that the airlines are taking excellent care of passengers. All passengers are required to wear a mask, as is the staff, and the jets and the airports are cleaned rigorously every day. So I will be careful, wash my hands, and take all precautions. I'm not at all afraid.
Hi, my name is Lisa Browdy. I'm calling from Seattle. I would be very nervous about getting on an airplane or a train unless it was required that every passenger had their temperature checked before getting on board, and as long as everybody wore a mask through the whole trip. Since I see that as not terribly likely right now, I'm going to be doing all of my travel by car.
Keep those calls coming at us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Joining me now is Binay J. Wilson, an editor at the travel website The Points Guy. It's great to have you here, Binay.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Leslie Josephs, an airline reporter at CNBC. Thanks for coming back on the show, Leslie.
Thanks for having me.
So, Leslie, you heard there our last caller said she won't be getting on a plane unless it's required that every passenger gets their temperature checked and wears a mask. Are either of those measures being required by airlines right now?
Well, so far, major U.S. airlines are requiring masks. That's a new change that started this month. Mm. The challenge with that is, how do you enforce it? Will they kick someone off of a flight? Are they going to divert the flight? Probably not. There have been airlines are telling their cabin crews, you know, don't essentially create a big fuss if a passenger refuses, but try to talk to them. And these flight attendants are trained in de-escalation. Mm-hmm. So it is a requirement. The airlines are telling people, do not come on board without a mask. Try to wear them in common areas like ticket counters and gates like near the plane. But they're limited in what they can do because this isn't a federal rule.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually my next point. There's no federal body that's sort of setting the regulations for this?
Well, the federal agencies that handle air travel and public health have been discussing this. The Department of Homeland Security, under which TSA sits, is looking at potential passenger temperature checks, maybe thermal scanning that we've seen in some other airports around the world, or starting to see. But nothing has been done yet. So it's kind of this sort of hot potato of which agency is handling what. And what we've seen from FAA, what we've seen from the Department of Transportation, and even the CDC is recommendations, which only go so far.
Mm-hmm. So, Binay, what is the experience of traveling on an airplane and traveling through an airport like right now?
It's a lot less crowded. You come in, people have masks on. Most of the workers do have masks on. People are trying to avoid the kiosks. I'm a person that uses my phone for my boarding pass, and I don't mm-hmm. check a bag, so I don't have to worry about that. Different rules about spacing through security lines. Some lines are empty, and some lines I've seen photos of just normal TSA lines. Then after you go through, you know, some of the gate, depending on the airport, some of the gate hold areas can look a little crowded. food areas. I was working on a story about this. Airports are still trying to work out their regulations on how to keep people socially distant in restaurants and in food courts. Mm. And then, you know, once you get on the plane, we've all seen that famous photo of United, the packed flight.
Every single seat was filled on that flight,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes, after the airline said they were going to try and do some social distancing, although I don't know how you can do that. It's something that should be done, but realistically, you know, that's going to be a challenge.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit earlier about the federal stimulus money. Leslie, how much of a lifeline has that stimulus been for the airline industry?
Well, that's definitely helping them keep stay afloat. But the airlines are also going to the bond market and raising some equity sales and looking for other ways that they could raise money. And they've raised billions. There is appetite to lend money from private markets to airlines. But that money, and the reason why it's important is because it requires airlines to keep their entire staff through September 30th, and they can't cut their pay rates. So their hourly wages are still remaining the same. After September 30th, that's when things are starting to get dicey, and even into the summer, because often employees have to be warned when there's a big layoff coming under state rules. So it is helping them stay afloat, but the summer is the most important season for airlines. The second and third quarters, when, you know, the most lucrative for them, summer vacations. It's when probably the airports are usually most miserable and the planes are at their fullest. But after that point, it's a big question mark. I mean, what happens after that? And some of the executives are already starting to let employees know, you know, we expect to be smaller airlines coming out of this. And it is possible that they do have involuntary furloughs and layoffs.
I know I've been seeing some tantalizingly cheap flight deals in the past few weeks. Binay, are these deals calling you, or are you sort of staying away from them?
They are very, very tempting. I'm a person who loves to travel, but I am not quite comfortable enough yet to pull the trigger.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what can we think about in terms of the long term for passenger costs?
Well, this is going to have to be paid for somehow. You know, all these the cleaning of the plane, the extra cleaning. The money is going to have to come from somewhere, and 9 times out of 10 that comes with airfare. So I would not be surprised after the summer, once things have kind of calmed down, that we start seeing airfares rise.
Right, right. And Leslie, I'm thinking about the transition away from person-to-person contact happening in airports. How can we expect this to affect airline security?
Well, the TSA is starting to think about this, but it's a very difficult thing to trace. So you can screen people for temperatures, which of course is a symptom of COVID, and maybe like weed out people that are over 100.4 degrees. And then also maybe if someone is sick, that even just going through that might be a deterrent, but it's not really clear yet what it's going to look like. I mean, it's still up for debate. Like I said, the Department of Homeland Security is looking at those kinds of screenings. We're not at a point where like people are getting mass tested for COVID or mass temperature checked at the airport. But it is likely to add some time to the security check, and also keeping that social distance at airports, security lines, they're trying to space people out. Maybe some checkpoints have closed because the demand for air travel has been so low and is likely to stay low compared with historical levels for a long time. Even with the uptick that we've seen, I think we're still off like 90% from where we were a year ago, you know, the start of the summer, spring and summer travel season. So it is likely to add some time to the process.
Yeah, and do any of the changes that are happening right now raise any new concerns for you when it comes to passenger privacy or even cybersecurity?
Well, airlines have been looking at things like facial scanning instead of a boarding pass for a bit, which has raised privacy concerns and other issues. But since it's a public health crisis, and one that has destroyed air travel demand pretty much like nothing else that we've ever seen. Airlines are really pushing the sort of the safety angle and looking at things like immunity passports, which, you know, aren't necessarily around the corner, but it, like, once we get mass testing, it's still possible. And travelers, like they have always had to weigh with air travel, have had to weigh privacy versus convenience. And that's going to be a question that every traveler faces when they go off on their
trip.
And
when you say immunity passports, you're referring to people who have gotten testing for antibodies, right? And maybe have been cleared for having antibodies. How are airlines thinking about that? Is that immunity testing really seen as something that they can give people a sort of immunity pass on?
I don't think that they, one, want to do any of the testing, but it could be something that could be required possibly down the line. It is somewhat theoretical, and it's very early days with testing as well. So if you have the antibodies, are you guaranteed to never get or transmit COVID again? So those are some of the questions, like how effective is it to even have somebody cleared? And it raises all sorts of other issues in terms of privacy.
Yes, yes. Binay, what do you think might be some of the long-term changes to the air travel experience based on this? I mean, a lot of people look back at September 11th as a time when we completely revamped how we go through security. What might we see come out of this?
Well, I think we're going to see a lot more of social distancing as a requirement. I'm saying we're going to see the spots on the floor. We're going to see a lot of more self-help options as far as checking bags and checking in and everything. I think we'll see more people using their mobile phones to do all of these processes. I think we'll see spacing in gate hold areas, although with some older airports that might cause some issues. I also think we will see the way the airport operates as far as foods and airport lounges. There's going to be a lot of changes. You're not going to be able to go up to the soda machine and just get your soda anymore. Things like that.
Actually, you wrote about how there are some new vending machines in airports now, right? With face masks and other sorts of things?
Yes. Las Vegas Airport started a vending machine that has N95 masks, Clorox wipes, hand gloves, all kinds of things. Yes.
We'll have to leave it there. Binay J. Wilson is an editor at the travel website, The Points Guy, and Leslie Josephs is an airline reporter at CNBC. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As we've reported on this show, cruise ships were early hotspots for the infectious disease, and the cruise industry effectively shut down in early March, with many believing that the crisis would only last for 30 days. And while passengers and some ship's crew members have been sent home, it's now 2 months later, and 100,000 crew members are still stuck at sea. And for those on board, life has been difficult. Some workers aren't being paid, and in many cases, they don't know when they can go home. Taylor Dalvin has been following this story closely. She's a business reporter covering tourism for the Miami Herald.
So the cruise industry really had a front row seat to the effects of this virus way back in early February. While the rest of the world outside Asia was still trying to figure out what this might look like long term for the entire globe, the largest outbreak outside of China as of mid-February actually happened on the Diamond Princess cruise ship anchored in Japan. And so the initial response was really to ramp up screening. Companies prevented people who'd recently traveled to Asia from boarding ships all over the world, said they were cleaning more often and doing health screenings of passengers before boarding. But as we know, those measures were not enough to prevent dozens of outbreaks on cruise ships across the world. And as the virus spread, it definitely spread through cruise ships globally.
And I think many of our listeners will probably remember the panic and getting people off of cruise ships and what that was like. But what people may not realize is that many crew members have since then been in limbo and been on these ships. Why are these crew members still stuck at sea?
Yeah, so the cruise industry finally decided to halt operations on March 13th after repeated outbreaks on cruise ships. And you're right, after that, it was a scramble to get ships back into ports. A lot of countries denied those ships. So here in South Florida, we sort of became a safe haven for some of these ships and saw a lot of passengers getting disembarked and repatriated here in South Florida. But yes, crew members largely remained on board. The industry really thought on March 13th that they were only going to be pausing operations for a month, for 30 days. Mm-hmm. And so they even brought more crew on, you know, sent some home, but brought more on in that month. And then when it became clear that the industry would be shut down for much longer than 30 days, they were really stuck in the situation of ramped up travel restrictions across the world, an incredible cost of getting all these people home. And so, yes, we've seen now, you know, 2 months after that initial shutdown, that thousands of crew members are still stuck on board without much reliable information about when they're going to be going home.
Oh, my goodness. And do you have actual numbers on that? Do you know how many crew members have been affected by COVID-19?
Yeah, so we're at the Miami Herald, we're actually tracking the number of positive cases linked to cruise ships and the number of deaths. And we know that at least 500 crew members have tested positive since the industry shut down on March 13th, and at least seven have died.
You mentioned that it's been tricky trying to figure out how to repatriate all of these crew members. Tell us who works on these ships. Where are these crew members from?
So most crew members are not U.S. citizens, are international crew, and a lot of them are from the Philippines. Mm-hmm. That's a really big nationality for crew members, also Indonesia and India. But yes, they come from, you know, over 100 countries. And so these companies are navigating travel restrictions that range from, you know, still open for commercial flights to not allowing under any circumstances crew members to return. And those travel restrictions are changing. And so it's been sort of a logistical nightmare. But meanwhile, you know, these people remain on these ships and are just waiting for news about when they'll be able to see their families again.
Yeah. And Taylor, you have been in touch with many crew members for your reporting. What are you hearing from them? How are they doing?
The ones I'm in touch with are not doing well. They're just really, really desperate more than anything for transparency and reliable information about exactly what their company and government are doing to get them out of this situation. A lot of them have been told repeatedly that they'll be flying home on one day, only to see that date canceled. And this has happened, you know, 5, 6, 7 times. Mm. And so it's really wearing on them. And it's a difficult situation. I mean, they're no longer being paid. They are not able to leave. And a lot of them are worried about their families at home and just really want to get there to be with them during this difficult time.
Taylor, you said they're no longer being paid. They're not being treated as paid working employees at the moment.
No, there are a certain number of crew on each ship that are working. Even the mega ships require at least around 100 people to operate them when they're not in, you know, full cruising mode. But most of the rest have been relieved of their contracts and so are no longer being paid. Some companies are paying, like Royal Caribbean, for example, is paying, giving what they're calling goodwill payments to crew of about $13 a day. But crew tell me that they're having to spend most of that on toiletries and other supplies on board.
Oh, gosh. And you've also reported that there have been a few apparent suicides connected to this, right?
Yeah, it's as with any suicide, you know, it's difficult to know the circumstances, but we know of a few instances during this time since the industry has shut down where crew members have committed suicide, yes.
Mm. Now, because these cruise ships are often operating in international waters, who regulates them? And do any labor laws apply that could be helpful to these crew members?
So U.S. labor law does not apply because these are, while all of the cruise companies are headquartered in South Florida, they're incorporated in other countries, and then their ships are flagged to often another country. And so the sort of international body that regulates this is the International Labor Organization. And they've come up with recommendations for shipping companies on how they should be treating employees during this time, but the enforcement really falls to the flag state. In a lot of cruise ships are registered in the Bahamas, so that would be one, for example, or Malta is another popular one. But we haven't so far seen any big oversight when it comes to the payment issue there, for example. But it is sort of a patchwork of laws. You have the ship's flag state, then you have these international groups associated with the UN, then you have where the ship is based. And so it's often difficult to tell.
What's the role of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in a situation like this? Do they have any role?
Yeah, they definitely do. And they have stepped up their oversight, I would say, during this time. Whenever the ship is in U.S. waters, CDC rules apply to how it operates. And so they've come up with strict protocols for how companies can disembark and repatriate crew since mid-April. They've been requiring that repatriation to happen on private transportation, which has caused a rub with some of these companies who are not seeing any revenue and now have to charter flights for thousands of people to go home. But they are definitely taking, I would say, a stepped up approach to oversight here. And I'm sure they'll be involved in drafting protocols for when cruises start up again.
Yeah. And last I heard, at least Carnival Cruise Lines is thinking about how to start up again at the end of the summer. What are you hearing from these cruising companies, and what are you hearing from crew members about what it will mean to start up again?
Yeah, most cruise companies have decided to cancel cruises through end of July, which is the CDC has actually banned cruising in the U.S. through at least July 24th. So we're looking at August 1st possibly to start. And while none of the companies have come up with protocols publicly about what they'll do, they've all said that cruising will definitely look different. Crew members that I'm in touch with are really just hoping to get home and are hoping to get back to work, you know, once they're able to reunite with their families and recover from this. But I think we can be sure that cruising is going to look a lot different. You know, the same kind of changes we're seeing on land will definitely apply there too. Masks, social distancing, et cetera.
Those things seem like they would be very different, though, on the confines of a cruise ship. I mean, what are some other changes that are being talked about that could considerably change what the cruise industry looks like?
Yeah, definitely. Doctors and infectious disease experts say that cruise ships are incredibly dangerous environments for this virus's spread, comparable to, you know, nursing homes and prisons and other long-term confined environments. And so, you know, disinfecting will be really important. I've talked to experts who recommend that ships not go on voyages at full capacity. So maybe consider filling just half of the ship with passengers, that they not go too far away from land at any time, to always have a land hospital available, because cruise ship infirmaries typically only have capabilities to treat one person in critical condition, one sort of ICU ventilator situation. And so those are some of the things that are being floated, but we don't know yet what these companies will do.
I would think that one of the things that this has highlighted is the fact that when you're working with an international crew on international waters in a situation like this, which is unprecedented, what should happen to those people? Are there any considerations and changes to labor laws that could affect how crew members might be able to travel home in a situation like this if it happens again?
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion. I haven't heard of anything in the works, but we have actually seen late last week a maritime attorney here in Miami filed a petition for emergency relief from the federal court here, to get these people, basically asking a federal judge to order the companies to send these crew home as soon as possible. And other attorneys I've talked to, you know, agree that this is a long shot. It's not clear if a federal court in the U.S. has any sort of standing, even though these ships are in U.S. waters, often docked in U.S. ports. You know, they do operate under foreign flags and have international crew. But, you know, people are really desperate at this point. And so that's an example of one effort to try and get a U.S. judge to try and intervene, citing the humanitarian crisis here.
Mm. Taylor Dalvin is a business reporter covering tourism for the Miami Herald. Taylor, thank you for your reporting. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
We heard from many of you about foiled summer travel plans. For a lot of us, it's up to books to take us far away this summer, and we have some recommendations for you, courtesy of Constance Grady, book critic for Vox. Constance, it's great to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
So I made the mistake of trying to read some nonfiction in the early weeks of lockdown, and boy, my brain was just asking to be taken away somewhere. In your view, what makes a book a great escape?
There are two things that you want in an escape book. You want this really driving forward narrative that will keep you reading and make it feel like it's just purely fun and never homework. But I'm also a little bit of a snob, because I have to be since I'm a book critic. So I always want in my escape book to have beautiful, beautiful sentences, so I never get distracted by thinking, oh, well, that's a little bit clunky. I think those two things together are what makes a perfect escape book.
Good writing and strong storytelling.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's start. You brought a list. Let's start at the top. Tell us about The Enchanted April.
This is a really lovely book from 1922 by Elizabeth von Arman. It's about a bunch of middle-aged British ladies who get sick of taking care of their husbands. So they all decide together to just up and go off on vacation together to an Italian island for a month. There's lots of descriptions of like wisteria growing everywhere, and they're sitting on the terrace drinking cocktails. It's just delightful.
So that sounds pretty classic in a lot of ways. The next pick on your list is, it seems, a very different kind of story. Tell us why you loved The Vanishing Half.
Oh, gosh, I love this book. It comes out next week on Tuesday. It's by Britt Bennett, who wrote The Mothers, her debut novel, which came out a couple of years ago. It is so rich and so interesting. It's about two twin sisters growing up in a small town in the South. The town is all black, and everyone in it is devoted to making sure that each successive generation of residents has lighter skin. These two twin sisters run away from the town. One of them begins passing for white, and the other one marries a darker-skinned man and has a darker-skinned child. It's so rich and interesting, and the writing is just beautiful. I keep stopping as I read to just sort of luxuriate in the sentences.
Now, I want to read the headline of the review that you wrote for your next book pick. You wrote, Gideon the Ninth is about lesbian necromancers in space. Obviously, it's perfect.
So the tagline on this book is lesbian necromancers in space, but really it's so much more than that. It's this gothic fantasy. The prose is just velvety. There's this incredibly involved mystery plot that I can never figure out. There's a romance. I cried at the end. It's a fantastic book. The sequel, Harrow the Ninth, comes out in August.
Does it remind you of anything? If you could guide our listeners, you know, if you like this, if you like X, you might like this book.
It's not really a space opera type book the way you might think of like a Star Wars story. It's more magic that happens to happen in space. So I think the closest thing would probably be like a little bit Game of Thrones, but fewer terrible, terrible people.
Okay, well, let's go on to the next pick. We are back to the theme of sisters, but this is a very different backdrop than the American South. Tell us about The Seamstress.
So this is a beautiful, beautiful book by Frances de Pontes Pipes. It's about two sisters in 1930s Brazil. Both of them are great seamstresses, but one of them ends up marrying rich and the other one becomes an outlaw. It's got this really, really smart, fast narrative that just pushes you all the way through. And it's all powered by this fraught relationship between the two sisters.
Now let's turn to Queen of the Night, which gives us a little bit of history, a little bit of art, What makes this book a great escape for you?
Oh, man. So this is by Alexander Chi. He's a literary novelist who got a lot of acclaim for his first novel, Edinburgh, which is very spare and grounded in realism. Queen of the Night is not that. It's one of these books where every emotion is really outsized and operatic because mostly it's about an opera singer who is in Paris at the end of the 19th century in Second Empire France. So there's lots of opulent descriptions of all these ornate clothes and furnishings, and everything is very over the top and happening at like level 10 all times. It's very easy to get lost in.
Okay, next on your list, two novels that have cities very front and center, City of Girls by Elizabeth Gilbert and The City We Became by N.K. Jemisin. So tell us why these made your list.
Ah, they're wonderful. They're both New York books. They're both very joyous and really compelling. City of Girls is a historical novel set in the 1940s at a rundown vaudeville theater. It reads like drinking a glass of rosé. You just want to guzzle it down. City We Became is science fiction by the Hugo winner N.K. Jemisin. The premise is that New York City is coming to life and each borough is represented by a different avatar, and they have to team up together to save the city from reactionary politics and racism, and it's just so much fun to read.
Mm. So Constance, before we let you go, what has been the most surprisingly exciting, soothing, or even distracting book for you during this time, beyond what's on this list already?
Oh, man. Well, I'm someone who, in times of deep, deep stress, I always think the best thing to read is a how-to guide by a control freak, because it'll really give you a sense of, like, the world is under control. There are, like, rules and regulations that you can learn and follow. So a book that I find very soothing in this time is a housekeeping manual by Cheryl Mendelson called Home Comforts. Like, she will tell you exactly how many inches you need to turn down your sheets when you're making your bed. She is on it.
And is this a modern manual?
Yes, it came out in, I think, 2005. And it's been updated a few times, I believe. So she's up to date on all of the latest technology, and she will tell you exactly what to do with everything.
Wow. Okay. Tell us a couple of habits and new things that you've picked up from this housekeeping manual that are giving you comfort at this time.
Oh, so I actually very rarely do any of the things in the book. I just like to read
it. It's just about reading it?
Yeah. It makes me feel sort of grounded and like, you know what? This woman has her environment under complete control. There is order in the universe somewhere.
When you are not reading fiction books, do you have favorite nonfiction books that you like to turn to at a time like this?
Yes, I think another one for me is this M.F.K. Fisher book of essays called How to Cook the Wolf. She was a food writer in the mid-century. She's probably one of the best prose stylists in American letters. Mm. And this was the book she wrote about cooking during World War II. First of all, when there are rations and things are scarce, but also just getting comfort from her food in a time of terror and stress. And it's really grounded and really visceral. And she's just a lovely, lovely writer and who's able to make the food very evocative and really grounded in physical senses.
Constance Grady is the book critic for Vox and the host of the Vox Book Club, which you can find at vox.com/book club. Constance, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, everyone, that's it for us today. You can find Constance's full list of book recommendations, including a few that we didn't get to talk about today, at thetakeaway.org. And of course, you can call us anytime about anything at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at thetakeaway. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Shamita Basu, and this is The Takeaway. I'll see you tomorrow.